This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
If you listen carefully tonight, you may well learn something. You may save yourself some money, and who knows what you may do if you listen tonight. And here's why I say that. Quite a number of years ago, I began to have guests on the power question, on our grid, on being self-sufficient, on all kinds of things like that. And I learned all kinds of interesting things, like, well, gee, like my appliances, for example. They were at the time about 13 years old, you know, the washer, the dryer, the refrigerator, that sort of thing. And I had a guest on who said, you know, new appliances take about a third or a fourth the amount of electricity that what you have right now does. And then I learned about solar panels and wind power. And then I learned about heat. We live here in the desert where on average it's up to 105 or 6 degrees every day now during the two brutal months we have in the desert. And so you have to build things not to emanate heat as much as possible. So I have revolutionized my household. I am independent of the grid. I have both wind and solar power in abundance, and I have all the equipment to generate it, and that's what I use in my home. Then I changed all my appliances. Then I went around and changed all my light bulbs. Then I took these heat-prone monitors and got them out of here and put in LCD screens. And, you know, slowly over the years, from listening to my own program, I've changed the way I live. My wife and I have changed the way we live. And you, too, can do that or part of it. If you listen carefully to tonight's guest, who is Richard Perez, he's the publisher for Home Power Magazine. Now, he facilitates the work of the magazine's editorial, art, advertising, production, sales, web, CD-ROM crews. His primary job, he says, is digital janitor. He maintains and upgrades Home Power's extensive computer systems and writes articles and editorials. Richard has been living and working off-grid since way back in 1970, a long time before I thought about it, with a photovoltaic and wind electric system. Richard's goal is to change the way people make electricity. So if you listen tonight, you just may learn. Ladies and gentlemen, Home Power Magazine's Richard Perez. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hello, Art, and thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I cannot think of a more important subject than what we're about to talk about. Now, everybody, I think, remembers California's not-too-distant problems with electricity, where they had brownouts and blackouts and all kinds of troubles with the grid in California, shortages, that kind of thing, and that was a little taste, just a little taste. What kind of shape is the grid in, the electric grid, across the U.S.?
Well, I'll tell you, it's felt better. it's getting old. The power plants, the transmission line infrastructure, was by and large created 20 to 30 years ago, 40 in some cases, and even longer. The utilities have been running lean. And they haven't been investing the kind of money they should have been investing in upgrading the transmission lines and power plants. So what we've got here is a basically aged infrastructure that is stretched very, very thin. And it's not just a matter of things like natural disasters, accidents. You know, now we have to deal with things like sabotage,
right,
fuel supply limitations, and an ever-increasing demand for electricity. So what we've got is a situation where this whole structure is poised to fail, and it has failed for, well, things like the financial concerns that caused the California energy crisis. And these are things I call energy sharking, Enron-like activities.
Mm.
And also, well, we're not sure what caused the East Coast, Midwest blackout.
They never Didn't they nail that down? I thought they did to some small power plant somewhere.
Yes, and I've heard everything from that to it was a tree branch across some high voltage lines. I don't think they're ever going to definitively pin down exactly what caused that. But the point is, it is a house of cards, and it is a house of cards that is stressed heavily, and any small failure anywhere in this massive grid can bring down whole sections of it.
All right, let me ask you this. Let's back up a little bit. You said that they had not, I understand that putting in new electric lines where there had not previously been lines would be a challenge in today's world because we have environmentalists and people who don't want you crossing properties and they don't want electric lines near and all the rest. But why have they not upgraded the current infrastructure that we have?
Well, there's a number of reasons. People's objections is a big one. It's a not in my backyard syndrome.
No, I've got that, but that would be respect to new things. With respect to the lines they have up now, why not put up new wire, new insulators, upgrade?
Well, upgrading a power line is only slightly less expensive than building it in the first place.
Oh.
And what we're talking about here is roughly $1 million a mile.
Oh.
In other words, about the same type of money it takes to lay down a freeway, a four-lane interstate highway.
Very expensive.
Yes, extremely expensive, not including the legal work that goes up front into obtaining right-of-way for this. So the utilities spend roughly half of the money that they take in on their expenses. They're spending half of it on the maintenance, upgrading, and establishment of new power lines. Currently, we've got about 160,000 miles of high-voltage lines in the USA, and we could use additionally, it depends on which expert you talk to, but somewhere between 25 and 45,000 additional miles. And every time I see a notice where a utility wants to put up a line or whatever, the people in the path of the line are going, no, no, no.
I know.
Not in my backyard. And believe me, I can see their point. I live way off grid, 6 miles from the nearest place where you could plug in a light off the grid.
Oh, well, then you're... If you're that far from even a connection to the grid, then you had no choice.
Well, no, I had no choice, and that's what got me started in 1970.
When you moved there, had you decided, all right, I'm going to become energy self-sufficient in my new home, and that's what I'm going to do?
Well, no, I decided I was going to be 1880s. When I moved to the country.
So you were going to have candles and...
Candles, kerosene lights. I hauled our water by hand.
I see. And when did that change?
Oh, about 6 or 7 years into the process, I decided that, hey, it was time to join the 20th century because 1880s life is just too damn tough.
Mm-hmm.
Hauling water gets very, very old. But
sure.
Even though I'm 6 miles from the end of the nearest, 120-volt light socket, mm-hmm. I have a high-voltage line running three-quarters of a mile from my house.
All right. Oh, really?
Yes.
All right. So what have you done? You are independent to what degree? What have you put up?
About 4.2 kilowatts of photovoltaic panels.
Excellent.
1,500-watt wind generator. And then the court of last resort, which is a 6,000-watt gasoline-powered generator. I'd rather eat a bug than turn it on, but if all else fails, I will turn it on.
Yeah.
And we run it about 150 hours yearly.
Uh-huh. How often do you have to turn it on? How frequently?
Well, during the summer, not at all, and during the spring, not at all, during the fall. But during the winters here in Oregon, I'll run it on average maybe once or twice a week. When extended cloudy periods hang on.
Sure. And that does occur in Oregon. Okay, so you've got 4,000 watts of electrical energy, and then you must have do you have a battery bank to store it?
A big battery bank. I can store enough energy to last us for 4.5 to 5 days.
That's damn good. So what do you have, a lot of deep cell type things?
Yes. Large storage cell batteries, I can store about 65 kilowatt hours of energy battery.
That's excellent.
Right. And when, you know, second, third day of no sun and no wind, we start conserving.
Sure.
And then we start, you know, oh, no, it's not time to vacuum the house. Oh, no, it's not time to do the wash. It can wait till later.
Yep.
And, you know, eventually, if the sun doesn't come out, we'll light up that gas generator, we'll burn it for 2 or 3 hours, and then everything goes on.
All right, let me further ask, do you take the output of the battery bank that you have and then convert it into 110 volts or 240 or something like that? Do you have inverters, in other words?
Oh, yes.
You do, all right.
Oh, absolutely. Gone are the days when everybody ran a 12-volt household. That was the very early days of off-grid living back in the early 80s. And
so in these days, then, you can have the solar panels out there, folks. They can be feeding a battery bank, and that battery bank then goes to what's called an inverter, and that changes it into 120 or 240 volts, as you would normally have in your home. You run it into your house, and then what, Richard? What have you done inside the house?
Oh, well, our house is electrically normal. People who walk in there are amazed that we're not on grid. We have every particular giga that we want. And it's just that whatever we do the research and we spend that additional amount of money, and it's generally not much, probably another 5 to maybe even 15% on some cases, to get the most efficient appliance possible to do that job.
Right.
And we have 2 refrigerator freezers. We have a home theater system. We have 5 computer systems with a network. We have satellite internet, compact fluorescent and LED lighting.
All right for you.
I mean, it's the house is cycling. Well, when we're getting the sun and we don't really particularly have to pay attention to how much we're using, we can cycle 12 to 17 kilowatt hours of renewable energy every day, which is enough to power a downtown home, you know, with the possible exception of things like an electric stove. Our stove is run by propane, our cook stove.
Mm-hmm.
For heat, we use solar heat in the winter. And we use passive solar cooling in the summer.
When you say you use solar heat, what?
Oh, our home is a passive solar home. It's also an active solar home. By that I mean the building is situated in such a way that it catches the south. It's got a lot of windows on the south face, and it is facing due south.
Right.
That's the passive angle. The building is super insulated. It's about R30 in the walls and R60 in the ceilings. And it also has an active solar heating system with 4 flat panels on the roof that drive a thermal slab on the ground level of the building.
Huh.
And this slab is concrete, and it has and it's faced with beautiful Spanish tiles, and it has tubing embedded in the slab, so when the sun comes up, the differential thermostat says, hey, the collectors are hotter than the floor, let's pump heat.
Huh.
And it runs all day long.
So I want to get this straight. These tubes are embedded, you put them in and then pour concrete over them, is that correct?
Yes, that's
right. And the concrete, I take it, absorbs the heat during the day quite readily and passes it on to these tubes that, what, have water in them or something?
Yes.
And then,
plain old water.
Okay, and then that water circulates into what?
Into solar collectors on the roof. Flat plate collectors.
Right.
4 by 8 foot, 4 feet wide, 8 foot long panels on the roof.
And then how does it transfer that heat to your home?
Just from radiation and convection off the slab.
Huh.
And the slab will store 3 to 4 days of heat for the house. Once we get it warm, and I mean warm, my wife Karen and I have walked around on it barefoot, and it is distinctly warm to the touch. And when there's snow on the ground outside, we used to have a wood stove, and we still have one for backup. And although we don't burn it much, we cut our wood consumption, and we're in a place where we get 3 and 4 feet of snow during a winter. We've cut our wood consumption from 4 to 5 cords a winter down to half a cord of wood per winter.
Gee, that's more for aesthetics than real heat.
Well, there are times when we'll get two-week and three-week cloudy periods here in Oregon. It doesn't happen very often. Last winter was a good example. In November and December, we had one. So we'll light the stove up and burn it for a few hours. And because the house is so well insulated, it traps that heat, and we can cruise for a couple, 3 days before we have to do it again if the sun doesn't come back.
All right. Well, you're a pretty good example because I live, for example, in a solar paradise where clouds are the rare exception. We have almost all sunny, windy days, so it's ideal for this kind of thing. But you're a better example because you live in Oregon where, well, frankly, there's a lot of rain and a lot of cloudy days, and yet you're doing it anyway. So people can't really say, I live in Oregon, I can't do it. Wrong.
People just don't live where there isn't enough sunshine to run solar heating for their home and their hot water, and also solar power for their appliances, solar electricity. Home Power has many readers in the western Washington area around Seattle. And, I'm in southern Oregon, where it's pretty much kind of like northern California. We get quite a bit of sun. But if you can run it in western Washington around the Seattle area, you can run it just about anywhere.
Indeed. So, you know, these people who put it off because they think they live in areas that won't support it are basically wrong.
People just don't live where there isn't enough sunshine to do this.
All right, the next question most people would ask is, all right, look, I don't live in a house that was originally designed with the kind of insulation Richard probably has and all the rest of that. Suppose I wanted to begin now, and I wanted to begin to change my life, and I own a home, and I've got a backyard, a little backyard, and a little front yard. What can I do, and how much is it going to cost me?
Well, the first thing to do is reduce the load. And there are two major loads in the house, electrical and thermal. In the electrical, well, there's an armada of things we can talk about to reduce that load. On the thermal side, it's a bit more difficult because it involves retrofitting the house. For example, if the house has single-pane windows, pop them out. Put in double-pane windows.
How much difference does that make?
Oh, a huge difference. A single pane of glass is R0.5. A modern window is R3.
Really?
Yes. And also, if the house has a lot of north-facing windows...
Richard, I want to stop you. Is there a way that you can help me understand what these R ratings mean? In other words, for example, the difference between a 0.3 and a 3 or something like that. What does it mean?
It's huge.
Well?
It is roughly a tenth the transmission of heat.
In other words, an R3 would be about a tenth the transmission of a 0.3?
Yes.
And a normal window, a single-pane window, is a 0.3?
0.3 to 0.5. Depends on the thickness of the glass. Depends on a variety of factors, like outside wind.
But basically, pretty pathetic.
It's almost not there as far as heat is concerned. Heat goes right through it.
Heat goes right through it. All right, Richard, hold tight right there. Richard Perez from Home Power Magazine is my guest, and if you would like to live independent of the grid, independent, and I might add, in the long run, a lot more cheaply, then you're going to want to listen very closely this morning. Richard Perez from Home Power Magazine on Coast to Coast AM, roaring at you in the darkness from the high desert. I'm Art Bell. As I said, Richard, contractors and people sell homes are always throwing around R ratings. It's got R so-and-so. Is there some way that you can translate in a way that we'll all understand what these R ratings mean in terms of, I don't know, how much electricity you might save or how much heating bill you might save? So, because it doesn't mean a R whatever.
Well, it's not really an absolute value. In physics, R... is really what they call 1 over U, which is thermal conductivity.
See, you're not in land that people will understand.
All right, well,
let me try this. Let me frame it differently. Let's take a ceiling, for example. If I had an R20 ceiling and I went to an R 50 ceiling or 440 ceiling? In other words, what I'm trying to get at is...
You'd have half the heat loss when you did that.
I'd have half the heat loss.
That's right. You'd cut it in half.
That's something I can understand.
So, and you know, building codes generally, well, here on the West Coast in Oregon, they specify R19 in the walls and ceilings.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that's all the insulation that you can have there, but that's what they specify on new construction. Old construction can have anything from no insulation at all.
Right.
Just, you know, walls with a dead air space in there. And, you know, that's going to be like R2 or so, up to modern construction R19. But this doesn't mean you have to stop there. For example, if you've got an older home, and say it was built in the 50s or 40s, and it doesn't have 2x6 studs in the walls, it has 2x4 studs, and the insulation is barely there when it was installed, and now it's barely there at all.
Okay.
When it's time to paint it or re-site it and you strip the old siding off, you've got an excellent opportunity there to lay foam. This is basically a foam-based insulative material, 4x8 sheets, aluminum foil on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Lay up 1 inch, 2 inches of foam, and then put on the new siding.
And that would make how much difference?
Oh, that would give you roughly double the insulation that you had before. Depending on the foam product, you can go from R12 to R20 doing this. And in our home, it's conventional 2x6 construction with conventional foam in the, conventional fiberglass insulation in the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And then we added the foam outside before we added the siding material. And we doubled up on the foam on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing this, we came out with R30 walls and an R60 roof. And the thing virtually doesn't leak heat. It's very efficient. We live up in the mountains of Oregon, and it's cool at night. We're at altitude. So what we do is open all the windows at night in the summertime, let the cool mountain breezes roll through, chill the house down. In the morning when we get up, we close them. It can be 90, 95 degrees outside, and it'll be 70, 75 degrees inside.
That's very impressive.
And so insulation is a two-edged sword. Not only does it save you heat in the winter, but it reduces your summer cooling load, which is critical in areas like where you live, Art, and
in
the South. And so insulation is not just for people who live in the freezing north. It's for people who also live where it gets hotter than hell in the summer. And you don't have to stop with R19. You can go beyond that.
Now, obviously, you know, each situation is going to vary, but is there a way to understand the expense involved in doing this if you were, say, replacing your siding? How much more am I going to spend?
Well, just replacing the siding, you'll probably add 20% or 25% to the bill by putting this insulation underneath it. If you're building a house from scratch and you want to do this energy-efficient insulative number on it and use good windows to boot, 5 to 7% of the cost of the house would be put into this.
Not that bad.
Not that bad at all. You're going to get it back in the first five cooling and heating seasons versus burning, well, whatever you're burning for heat and whatever you're using, usually electricity, for cooling. So, you know, the first step towards any kind of energy self-sufficiency and any kind of sane energy picture is reducing the load.
Okay. It may have been you, Richard, I'm not sure, but at some point in the past, somebody like you or you made the statement that my appliances, which were, I don't know, 13, 14 years old, compared to new ones, washers, dryers, refrigerators, that sort of thing, compared to the new ones, would save some incredible amount of energy. I just could not believe it. And I checked on it, and sure as hell, you or whoever said it was exactly right. I think it was you. And I went out and bought new appliances, and oh my goodness, what a difference. What a difference.
Incredible differences. All right, let's just look at a light bulb, for example. fairly common item. Folks have them all over the place. They leave them on. A light bulb is 94% of the electricity you stick into it comes off as heat, not light. So it's actually a better electric heater than it is a light.
Right.
And if you're in a summer cooling area where you're running air conditioning and you have incandescent lights in your house, this, you're really nuts. You're working against yourself here. You go to a compact fluorescent light, which is delivering as much light for anywhere from a half to a third the amount of energy in, and it's producing very little heat.
Yes, and I think we should catch people up on something, Richard. Some time ago, just a few years ago, incandescent, or rather the newer lighting, was very, it was kind of rare, and they were oddly shaped, weird bulbs. Well, people should go back to the stores in their area and look, because now they're producing these incredible new bulbs that they just screw in like any other bulb. They're made more conventionally looking now than they used to be. They're shorter, stubbier, easier put in all over the place, and they're amazing because, oh, say a 60 watt bulb might burn 18 watts in electricity instead of 60. It's amazing, and it, plus you can put your hand on it. It's cool. Plus, it lasts how much longer, Richard?
Oh, 7 to 10 times longer.
7 to 10 times longer.
Yeah, and these things are not expensive anymore. When they first came out, they were, you know,
right,
$8, $12, $15 a pop. Now, $8 to $10 will buy you a 5-pack at your local discount store.
There you go. I mean, so, this is going to change the world by itself. If everybody went out and bought these new bulbs, I guess we would cut our energy load by probably a third across the U.S., wouldn't we?
Our residential energy load, you bet. Residential energy in the U.S. is about a third, commercial is about a third, and industrial is about a third of what the grid makes.
That's interesting.
We could eliminate somewhere between 5 to 7 major coal-fired power plants if America's residences would get rid of the light bulb and adopt compact fluorescence. And guess what? There's something else coming online that's even better than compact fluorescent.
You're kidding.
Yep, light-emitting diodes, LED lighting.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yes, this stuff is as efficient as the compact fluorescent is to the incandescent. The LED is that much more efficient than the compact fluorescent.
Yes, they're beginning to make these, folks, now in 110-volt fixtures,
right?
These LED arrays, and, man, they're incredible. I mean, I've got a few of them around here, and they use how much power for the equivalent of whatever?
Well, for a 40-watt reading lamp on your desk, you'd use a watt and a half.
A watt and a half?
Right, and they make virtually no heat whatsoever. And not only that, they have lifetimes in the hundreds of thousands of hours.
And these are now sold just about everywhere, aren't they?
Yes, most discount houses, once again, you can pick them up. And they're still a bit spotty as to where you can find them, and they're still a wee bit expensive in comparison with compact fluorescents, but they're coming on strong. And they are producing a species of white light. It's great to work by. And we use them, and they work well. And they inherently run on low-voltage DC, but they now have models that run on conventional, you know, 117 volts AC power.
And it uses so little power, you'd be hard-put to even measure it. I mean, they're incredible. Well, now, what percentage of the American people thus far do you think have made the transition from the conventional bulbs people go out and buy?
I'd say a few. I'm betting you somewhere around a third of the folks have compact fluorescents in their house, and more are using them daily. LED is just a tiny fraction of the population. So we still got a lot of work to do here. And this is just the light bulb. The house is full of other appliances, washing machines, refrigerators.
Yes.
Refrigerators are a prime example. A modern Energy Star refrigerator is going to consume somewhere between a half and a third of the amount of energy as one that was made oh, say 10 years ago, and a quarter of the energy of one that was made 20 years ago.
That blew me away.
Yeah, so, you know, Aunt Millie's, when she died and left you her old Kelvinator, well, God bless her, and it was nice that she left it to you, but believe me, you don't want to plug it in.
Yeah.
And folks, you know, they take the old refrigerator and they do things like stick it out in the garage where it's hotter than hell all day and let it run out there. These refrigerators are consuming an incredible amount of energy. For example, my wife Karen decided she wanted another refrigerator. And for years we had this 12-volt alternative energy refrigerator that cost a lot of money. It worked great, but it was too small.
Right.
So we went energy shopping for a refrigerator on the Internet, and we paid very close attention to the Energy Star labels. And the tests on these refrigerators, we wound up with a 27 cubic foot refrigerator that in our application uses 1.5 to 1.6 kilowatt hours of electricity a day. And this is in terms of solar electricity, it's about 4 modules worth of electricity.
1.5 kilowatts per day. Can you compare that then to the one you had? Well, no, not the one you had, but let's say one that's 15 or 20 years old.
It would be using roughly 15 to 20 years old, roughly 4 times that amount of energy.
4 times.
Yes. And you know, this. See, the grid and America's energy infrastructure has lulled us into thinking, well, you know, a kilowatt hour of energy. National average is about 7.5 or so cents per kilowatt hour. So, you know, to run that refrigerator, our new energy-efficient model is about a dime a day on grid, okay? And say to run Aunt Millie's old Kelvinator, well, you know, it's 40 cents a day.
A dime a day to 40 cents a day. And then multiply this by all these light bulbs and all these dryers and washers and refrigerators and all the rest of it.
Yep.
And then you're also talking about heat, the amount of heat. So this Energy Star thing is no joke. It's a real McCoy, huh?
Yes, it is, definitely. I wouldn't go looking for any electric appliance without consulting the little sticker that's right there in the showroom on the wall, and it'll tell you how much this thing is going to consume. And our research here at Home Power, you know, we not only buy these things, but we also install them, and then we put instruments on them and run them and see if it actually does what they say it's going to do, and we found them to be incredibly accurate.
Really?
Yes.
In other words, normally the claims they make are pretty good?
Yes, they are excellent. And you know, you can do other things to your refrigerator, too. For example, we have a pantry that is adjacent to our kitchen that is insulated out of the house so it gets cold in the winter.
Uh-huh.
And instead of putting the new refrigerator in the kitchen, we put it in the pantry. Where it is, you know, in the 50s during the winter, or even sometimes lower than that. And this resulted in even more savings on the refrigerator because it's operating in a cool location.
Sure.
So, you know, it's not only the appliance, but it's how you use it, where you locate it, and just obvious things like, you know, don't leave the TV on if nobody's in the room watching it. Don't leave lights burning in rooms where nobody is present.
Yeah, it makes sense. Just common sense.
Yeah, common sense sort of stuff. And what we found is that we can walk into the average grid household by changing a few light bulbs, maybe even changing a few major appliances, and paying a little common sense to electrical use. We can cut the electricity bill by at least 25% in a month. And with a little more care and spending a bit more money, we can cut it in half.
All right. Let's take the real plunge here. Let's say that I'm the average Joe out there right now, and I want to get off the grid. I mean, I just flat want to get off the grid. That's my goal, to completely get off the grid. How much am I going to spend to do that?
Well, if you did your homework up front and you've done an efficiency job on the house, it is dumb to go solar without doing the efficiency job, and do the efficiency job first. If you do that, you're going to spend less money on a solar electric system than you would on a good used car.
You're kidding.
No. The solar electric system that we have that powers our house is larger than normal.
How good a used car? in other words, what might somebody spend to actually be independent of the grid? Let's nitty gritty time here.
$15,000 to $20,000.
That's a really good used car.
Yes, that's a good used car.
Okay.
All right. But you know, at the same time, I see mountain cabins too. We profile them in Home Power. You know, our retirees in the mountains in
sure,
the cabin,
sure.
Where a solar electric system would cost them $4,000 to $6,000.
But let's stay with the $20,000. Let's say $20,000.
Yeah, $20,000 max. And you know, our system, we spent a bit more than that, but we're larger than normal. Also, we bought a lot of our modules back when they were more expensive. They're cheaper now.
I hear that. That it's getting better. But all right, $20,000. Let's say we spend $20,000. We're off the grid. How long is it going to take me? Or that person, to recover their $20,000?
Well, number one, I wouldn't recommend going off the grid.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'm off the grid because I'm 6 miles from the end of the power line.
Oh, yeah, I got that. Why not?
Mean,
why not recommend it? Why not?
Well, the grid needs your help. Right? I'm serious. It does. We now have 38 states with net metering laws.
Yeah.
Net metering laws say that if you put up a solar electric or a wind electric system and you maintain your connection to the grid, that you can sell the grid electricity at the same price that they charge you for electricity. So if they're charging you a dime a kilowatt hour, you can sell it to them for a dime a kilowatt hour.
That's fair.
That is extremely fair. And the point here is that I'm off grid by 6 miles. I mean, I asked the power company how much to run the lines in. I had to do it. I knew I couldn't afford it, but I had to ask. And they said, oh, about 200, this was in the mid-70s.
Yeah.
They said $280,000 unless there's something kinky going on.
Well, you mean if it's the average installation?
Well, no, it was per mile, and they said, well, if there's like mountains and creeks and right of way and all this, and it gets kinky and the prices go up.
Uh-huh.
So I thought $280,000, fine. So and we've got roughly about $30,000 invested in our system over the last 20 years, and so I figure in my case, hey, it saved me a lot of money right off. But there are times during the summer, many times during the summer, when we've got electricity coming out of our nose. We've sized our system such that during partially cloudy days and during the winter, we can get full quick and we have plenty of energy.
All right, Richard, hold tight right there. We're at the top of the hour and we'll be right back and continue with Richard Perez from Home Power. The grid needs you. You remember the thing with Uncle Sam? You know, they still have it, right? Uncle Sam needs you with the pointing finger. Maybe we need Carrie Kilowatt or something. You know, a guy with a beard, maybe, and hair standing, of course, straight up, you know, like he'd been just hit by 5,000 volts, and he could say, the grid needs you. Anyway, we're going to find out about that right now. Richard, what did you mean? Were you being facetious when you said the grid needs you?
No, I'm dead serious. The grid needs you. It needs all of us.
I don't get it. I mean, a guy who runs Home Power magazine ought to be urging people to be energy completely self-sufficient, you would think.
Oh, you can be energy self-sufficient and still be on grid.
Yeah?
A fact of life is that every renewable energy system has periods during most days when it's producing more than the people are able to store in their batteries if they're off-grid.
Right.
Or more than they can consume.
Right.
This is why we have regulators on the PVs to keep from overcharging the batteries.
So you mean then the grid needs your electricity?
Yes.
That's what you meant.
It needs your surplus generation.
You need to be clear about that. Okay.
Yes.
So you want people to put it up, but then you want them to share it with the grid.
Yes, share it with your neighbors. Help the grid out. The grid is stretched. Utilities call this distributed generation.
Mm.
And it makes the grid more reliable.
Sure, it
reduces
would.
The load on the grid.
Sure, it would.
And they will pay you what they're charging you for.
Yeah, well, some of them will. You know my story. I mean, I put up the solar panels and wind, all the rest of it, and I went down to my electric cooperative.
Yes.
And they said, oh, sure, we'll buy from you, but we'll buy only at the wholesale price while selling to you at the retail price. And I thought that was, well, actually, I just walked out.
Are you in the state of California?
Nevada.
Nevada, yes. Mm. Well, like I said, there are 38 states with these net metering laws. Just before Clinton left the White House, we had a national net metering law in committee where it died. And, of course, under the present administration, it's not even there anymore. But the point is, soon this will be a national law. But currently it is a law state by state. And the fine print is different in every state. In some states, you can actually get a check from the utility. In other states, the best you can do is break even. But you can break even. And, you know, say you have a solar electric system, and the kids are at school, and you're off at work, and during the day, it's spinning your electric meter backwards. You're pumping that energy onto the grid, and you're doing it at the grid's peak demand time.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is helping out the grid. And you know, I've had many meetings with utility people, and it's been a real uphill battle in every state. We worked for 4 years to get the law passed in Oregon, Oregon's net metering law. And it was an uphill battle here. They didn't want us.
Well, I know, I'm sure.
Yeah, they were just, oh, no, no, no. I mean, they've got this century-long paradigm. We make it, you buy it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden we're going, hey, wait a minute. We can make electricity any place. We can put up a solar panel. And with the modern utility intertie inverters, we can shove this energy right back at you.
Yes.
On grid.
Yes.
Spin that meter backwards.
Yes.
And this frightened them.
I'm sure it did.
Yeah. And so, you know, but now they're starting to come around, particularly in some states.
Why? What changed to bring them around?
Well, what changed is the advantages of solar electricity. Number one, here is a power-generating source that the utility gets to use the energy from, and it did not invest one red cent of its operating capital in this. You invested the money in it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't. So here we have free electricity for them.
Let's think about this for a second. If they're forced to buy at the same rate that you pay, in other words, retail, that's got to be a losing proposition for them, because like every other business, they buy electricity at a certain rate and then resell it at an inflated rate, hence that's how they make their money, their profit. That's where their profit comes from. So I just can't see how you would convince them that for them it would be a good deal.
Well, it's going to require a change in the utilities mentality, all right? You know, utilities 100 years from now are not going to be power producers. They're going to be power brokers. In fact, they are this already.
Yeah, they really are now. That's why I asked you the question. In other words, what argument do you make to make it attractive for them?
The argument I used on a major utility in Oregon was, do you want to keep these people as customers? All right? I can throw an additional 20% on the system in terms of money. I can install batteries, and I can tell you to take your electric meter and shove it. Okay? So do you want to keep these people as customers? And the advantage is you get this clean electricity, and I'm talking clean. No carbon dioxide, no carbon monoxide, no nuclear waste, no acid rain. I'm talking clean. You're getting it on peak. You're not paying a cent for the generating capability of this. There's lots of advantages for it. So much so that in countries that are a bit more advanced than we are, notably Japan and Germany, in Japan, if you put up a utility intertied photovoltaic system, the government will pay for half of it right out of the box.
Is that a fact?
That's a fact. In Germany, similar type incentives are available. So much so that, photovoltaic modules that are being made in the States here, or are being made by multinational corporations here in the States,
yes,
are getting hard to get a hold of because they're going to Japan and Germany because these people are paying more for them than we will.
Why do you think the Japanese and the Germans are so forward-thinking compared to us?
Well, in Japan, it's a an easy thing. I mean, they're a petroleum importing company, their country. They're, in other words, their energy sources are all imported. And in Germany, it's due in part to a large Green Party movement there, which is controlling the government and directing it. And they say it's better for the country. And there's a number of reasons, environmental, political. I mean, you know, the sun is very democratic. It shines on everyone every day. And it doesn't say, you know, there's nobody's going to war over sunshine. It's just good for the country to do this. And so that's the argument they're using in Germany. And they're putting up PVs much faster than we are. And in Japan, oh, all their energy is imported. The sun delivered free daily.
All right, let's get political for a second. I think we all know who President Bush is by now and what direction he's taken the country. And we don't know as much about Kerry, do we? Or do we? How much difference is there going to be in the next 4 years of energy policy compared to, you know, bearing in mind that one or the other would be elected or reelected?
Well, as far as the energy policy of George Bush, it was a total disaster. I mean, Dick Cheney won't even tell us what went on the secret backroom meetings with Ken Lay of Enron fame that structured his entire energy program, and so we don't even know what went on there. What we do know is that oil has hit $44 a barrel,
yep,
highest ever,
yeah,
and it isn't likely to come down. We've seen an end to cheap oil, period.
Do you really believe that's true?
Yes.
They talk a little vaguely about maybe energy prices coming down, perhaps after the summer, but by and large, you don't think that's going to happen, do you? You believe that the energy prices have gone up and they're going to keep going up and they're not going down again.
That's right. That's right. We have a worldwide natural gas shortage. We have a worldwide petroleum shortage. We're demanding more of it all the time. We've passed the peak of easy to get at stuff, easy to mine, easy to pump, easy to transport. It's going to get much, much more expensive, and in transportation particularly. Now, in electricity, well, here in America, we got a lot of coal, and we can keep mining it, and we can keep burning it for a while. But the environmental effects of doing this are becoming increasingly obvious.
Mm-hmm.
The price of electricity has been going up.
Mm-hmm.
The new power plants that utilities have been installing by and large, gas-fired, and gas is going up.
Richard, what's happening to oil is obvious. How closely linked to the price of oil is the price of electricity?
Well, during the last 3 years, the utilities have installed more petroleum-fired plants than ever before, a great increase. So they're burning it, too. But it's primarily transportation that is burning it. And, I mean, it's a wonderful energy source. You know, 20 gallons of gas in the tank is a huge hit of energy. And we're not likely to replace this anytime soon. But at the same time, the number of cars is going up. The number of miles people are driving in these cars is also going up.
Number of nations with cars, with citizens with cars, is going up.
If
people could see China, they'd get a cold chill right down their spine, what's coming in. And there's going to be a lot of international competition for what energy resources are left, right? I mean, we're not the only ones chasing after Mideast oil. It's going to be China and the rest of the world as well.
Yes, and you know, with George Bush's energy policy, things are going to keep going that way. And I fully expect to see a huge raise in gas prices after the election. I think they're being kept low now.
Anyone, you want to guess at how high gas is going to go after the election?
I can see well over $3 a gallon.
Boy, that'll change a lot.
It'll make people start looking at these new hybrid electric vehicles. These things are just amazing. I mean, it's an incremental step. Bottom line is we don't need to be burning petroleum for energy anymore.
All right, I saw a network piece on the cars that you're talking about, and it's interesting. They kind of took the other side of it, Richard, and they said, look, these hybrid cars are very interesting, and sure enough, it's fewer miles, or more miles per gallon, I guess I ought to say, you know, substantially more, but they said at the end of the day, with the maintenance and the whatever all the hybrid takes that other cars don't, you're not going to pay for it in the lifetime of the car. You're aware of that report, right?
Yes, I am. And
not true or true?
It's horse pucky.
Horse pucky.
Yes, it's horse pucky. These things don't require any more maintenance than any other motor vehicle. As a matter of fact, I have a Toyota Prius, which is a hybrid vehicle. It
right.
gets 60 miles to the gallon downtown. All you do is fill up the gas tank and change the oil every 7,000 miles. It doesn't even have a grease fitting on it.
Really?
You don't maintain the batteries. They're sealed in the back. You don't do anything to it.
On behalf of all the people out there who drive cars, I want to ask you a couple of questions. I've never test driven one of those. I've seen a few of them on the road. How is it for driving, for acceleration, for air conditioning, whatever all the American people are used to? How is this new hybrid? You're driving it. Tell us.
Well, the air conditioner kicks butt. I'm telling you, I've never had a car that cooled down as fast.
Really?
And I've never seen a car where I pull up to a stoplight or a stop sign, and I'll hit the brakes, the engine goes dead, the air conditioner keeps running.
Really?
On the battery. It has more pickup than a Toyota Corolla or any other, you know, mid-sized sedan.
Does it really? So
yes.
you can be away quickly from the stop sign.
Because when you stomp on this thing to get onto the freeway,
yes.
the engine goes to the max, and you still have this incredible 60-horsepower electric motor, which is also has got infinite torque at low RPM, and it just goes right onto the freeway.
All right.
It passes at freeway speeds. The thing is so darn quiet that you got to be careful not to get speeding tickets in it. it's a $20,000 brand new car. All right, I had to stand in line for 6 months to get this thing. I ordered it. 6 months later, it finally got delivered.
No
they're
kidding.
Back ordered so far.
No kidding. So, I mean, you really think then these people who are issuing these reports are nuts? They're wrong. They're just flat wrong.
Yeah, and they're also basing their pricing at, you know, $1.50 to $1.70 a gallon on gasoline. When gasoline starts hitting $3 plus, then the situation changes. Just the same way where solar electricity, you know, years ago was pretty expensive and it didn't look like a particularly good deal. But as electric rates climb and solar rates come down,
it looks better and better.
It looks better and better all the time.
Gotcha. So at any rate, back to the car for a second. You're perfectly satisfied in every way and you're getting 60 miles to the gallon with this thing.
Well, I wouldn't say I was perfectly satisfied. I underwent an intense retraining program when I first stepped into the thing and started to drive it.
In what way?
Oh, it's very different. The transmission never shifts.
You mean, go back to that.
The transmission doesn't shift. There are no gears. It's got a constantly variable transmission. There is no change from first to second to third.
It just
goes.
Wow.
And it took some training on Jackrabbit starts and Jackrabbit stops. We don't do that in it anymore. We plan ahead. Oh, yeah, the light's turning red up there. I think I'll take my foot off the gas and kind of coast and whatever. And then it's got a wonderful display on the dash that says, oh, you've just hit 99-plus miles to the gallon because you're not honking it. it's got feedback.
So it's giving you feedback all the time about how many miles per gallon you're...
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
That is extremely cool. And it's telling you when the electric motor is working, when the gas motor is working,
yes.
when the gas motor is charging the batteries, when regenerative braking, when you stop, if you hit the brakes a little bit, then the electric motor that's in there recharges the battery. In other words, you recoup some of the energy you expended on accelerating the vehicle when you decelerate. Now, if you stomp the brakes real hard...
So, wait a minute. Let me get this straight. They capture the energy, and there would be energy in a stop.
Yes.
The friction, and they... But that's fascinating. And then they store that stopping energy in the batteries. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes. Nickel metal hydride batteries. No cadmium, very low toxicity, all sealed up, about, about 30 kilowatt hours of energy stored in the battery.
That's really cool.
It is extremely cool.
All right. These batteries, it's a question everybody always asks. And now with the newer batteries, how long before you've got to replace them, Richard?
Toyota puts a 7-year warranty on this battery.
Really?
Yes.
And then the cost to replace when you finally have to?
Oh, I have no idea on that. You'd have to talk to Toyota. I have no idea how much it would cost to replace that battery. But since the entire vehicle is $20,000, I would say somewhere between maybe $1,000, maybe $1,500 to replace this battery.
God, that is such a cool concept. To use stopping power, for example...
Well, it's not only stopping power. When you climb a hill,
yes,
you go down the other side.
That's right.
And you expend energy to climb that hill, and you recoup some of that energy as you coast down the other side.
So you're actually, you're running something and charging a battery as your car goes down a hill.
Right.
Because that's generating energy. All right, Richard Perez is my guest from Home Power Magazine, and I'm learning all kinds of things that I didn't know about the world around me, the latest being this car. That is so cool. When you consider it, stopping, going down hills, all of that is a potential energy generator, and he's using it. You know how I see it? I see it this way. People don't have to go out and convert their house immediately to, you know, be off the grid or sharing with the grid or whatever, and they don't have to buy a new car right away or appliances or light bulbs or anything else. But it seems to me, Richard, that as life goes along, why, the next time you buy a light bulb, you buy one of these instead of rushing out and replacing everything. The next time an appliance goes out, you go and you look for the Energy Star. The next time you go to buy a car, you take a good hard look at the kind of car you just talked about. In other words, you do these things as the time for the decision about these things comes to pass naturally, huh?
That's it. You know, I've been working on this for, over 30 years now. And there's still, you know, things I'm replacing, things I'm changing. And no, you don't have to change your life overnight. But there are things that you can do overnight, like turn off those light bulbs in rooms where nobody's at. And there are mindful things that you can do. And the big ticket items, you know, converting to solar power, buying a new energy efficient vehicle. When the time comes to get a new car or to buy a used one or the time comes to re-side your house or re-roof it, that's the time to put some insulation in. So, you know, a bit at a time.
Well, I think for the average person, Richard, that the car you talked about, for example, now today, in today's world, 60 miles per gallon, man, that means a lot to people, Richard. That means a whole lot. 60 miles a gallon. For a lot of people who commute even an hour a day, think how much money that could mean.
Oh, yeah. And even better, I mean, say there's a coworker that lives, half a mile or a mile from your house. Pick him up and take him to work with you in your energy-efficient vehicle. Carpool. Drive less. There's all kinds of things that we can do. And back on the vehicles again, these hybrid gasoline vehicles are just great, but they're an interim step. They're still using gasoline.
Yes.
I mean, this is petroleum that is basically prehistoric plants that have molded for hundreds of thousands of years under the earth. We're pumping it up, and we're releasing this carbon into the atmosphere, global warming. We can short-circuit that whole cycle and burn carbon that we fixed last year in plants. For example, biodiesel. Two of the folks who work here at Home Power have biodiesel-powered rigs.
Meaning what, they're using what?
They're using French fry fat from the local McDonald's, strain the chunks out, give it a little treatment, and they do it in their garage.
If a person goes to McDonald's and wants to buy their excess fat, how are they usually greeted?
It depends. These days it's getting hard to find because more and more folks are doing it. But basically it is a vegetable oil.
Uh-huh.
And plants such as canola or rapeseed can be grown specifically as a fuel crop. And, you know, we grow it this summer and fix the carbon as the plants grow, and then we release the carbon throughout the year and do it again next year. This is a one-year carbon cycle instead of a 200,000-year carbon cycle.
Right.
Much better for the environment. Also, we don't have to go to places like Iraq to get this oil. We can grow it in Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas. We can grow it just about anywhere, California.
Well, Richard, since we're such gigantic consumers of energy compared to the entire rest of the world, then why do you imagine, Richard, that other countries are so much greener than we are? Why is Japan and Germany and all these other countries so? You would think we'd be leading the charge in the world toward a greener, cheaper, more energy efficient atmosphere, but we're not at all. How come?
Leadership. The leadership of this country for...
But that's what leadership is supposed to be all about.
Well, it's not what it's about. It's about dollars and corporations and oil. And, you know, our president is an oil man. A failed oil man, but an oil man nonetheless. And
you're not a big Bush guy, are you?
No, I'm not. And,
uh-huh.
And you know, I'm not a big Kerry fan either, but... you know, this coming election, I'm just urging people to vote for anybody but Bush. You know.
Look here. You know, there's only two. We had Ross Perot once. He was almost realistic, you know.
Yeah.
Other than that, though, realistically, Richard, there's only two men that you
That's
can
right.
vote for who are going to win. One of them's going to win. So I take it that you're probably a Kerry voter.
Yes. That would be a yes. And, you know, Kerry has some good energy policies. He's pushing for things like biodiesel and domestically made fuels from plants. And you know, I've heard all kinds of things about this. So how many acres would it take to grow all the gasoline that, you know, that this country needs? That kind of what-if mentality is really doing us a disservice. We're not going to convert this country's electricity from coal or nukes or natural gas overnight. We're not going to convert this country's vehicles from gasoline and diesel fuel overnight. This is going to take a long time. But it's going to take forever unless we get started. And that's the point. And it's just like you said, you don't have to go out and do all these things at once. It's just next time it comes around, make the decision for something that is ecologically sound, sustainable, and renewable. And that's what the whole thing with home power is about.
All right,
let's
yeah, okay. Richard, for a second, let's go back to oil itself.
Right.
We've got an oil president. I think most people agree with that. Yeah, oil. We're getting a lot of it from the Middle East. There's been an argument about Alaska, and I, for one, would like to understand, if you can fairly relate to us, what Alaskan oil means or might mean, and if they go ahead with this big fight, you know, they're having this big fight over Anwar, if they were to get to Anwar, how much oil might be at Anwar, and where are we kind of with oil right now?
Somewhere between 6 to 9 months of what we use.
That's what Anwar would be?
Yes.
That's not much.
That's not much. And the difficulty in doing it is enormous. We're talking about pipelines in a very harsh environment across a very long distance.
Well, it can be done. We've done it already.
We've done it already, yeah. And we've done things such as that before in countries not in the USA. In other places.
Well, I hear a lot of people talking about peak oil. You said it yourself earlier in the program. You said we have already pulled out the cheapest oil we're going to pull out of the ground. Peak oil. We really are there?
Yes, we're there. We're there now. We're going to see oil shortages probably as close as 5 years from now, to the point where it gets very expensive.
Are you sure about that? I mean, a lot of people argue with you, Richard. A lot of people argue, and they say this is such crap. We've got oil coming out our ears. There's more oil than we need. It's just, you're sure it's not true.
It's not true. For example, just recently, National Geographic magazine, their cover story, I believe it was the June issue of this year.
Yes.
The end of cheap oil.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not alone in saying this. The apologists for it are basically oil producers and oil men, the people that are saying, oh, we can keep doing this forever. No, we can't do it forever. We've already... you know, within maybe it was 2 years ago, maybe it'll be 2 to 5 years from now, where we pass the absolute peak. But the main thing is that our appetite for this black goo is just going nowhere but up. We're using more of it all the time. And the supply of it, well, you know, it went down into the ground 200,000 years ago. It's going to have an end. Now, whether the end was 2 years ago or 5 years from now, I don't really know. I don't think anybody really knows. But the point is, it is going to end. And experts, both sides, will tell you a number of things. The bottom line is, we need to use as little as possible about this. And on Kerry, you know, he's saying he wants to see 20% of America's vehicle fleets using renewable fuels by the year 2020.
This is
what he says. And
yes.
He wants to raise vehicle standards to 36 miles to the gallon by 2015. And from the look at hybrid vehicles, that's easily doable. I mean, Honda's making them. Ford just licensed the hybrid vehicle technology from Toyota. They're going to be producing their first vehicle. It's going to be one of their big SUVs.
Yeah, tell me something, Richard. Has the day of the muscle car gone?
Oh, definitely.
It's gone, huh?
Yeah, it's gone. I mean, if you want to build a muscle car, you'll build a hybrid muscle car with a battery in there. It'll get
hybrid,
off the line much faster.
Hybrid muscle car.
Yeah, I mean, it's... we're going to have all kinds of options, and what's going to make it happen is people doing it, people buying it. You know, I got to think that it's not politics or religion or whatever that is structuring our lives anymore. It's technology, and we vote for it by the technologies that we choose to adopt. We vote with our bucks. So when you buy an energy-efficient refrigerator...
that's true. I mean, that's it's supply and demand. That's how America works.
That's
what
right.
People want is so you got to make them want it.
And you know, and particularly in the case of oil and hybrid vehicles. I mean, currently about 65% of the world's oil reserves are in the Persian Gulf states, and that's a good reason why we're there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And about 3% of the oil's reserves in the world are in the American states, in the 50 American states. So, I mean, even if oil were to go on and on, which it's not, we don't have it anymore. They have it, which means we're going to have to import it, which means we're over a barrel here. We're going to be having wars. We're going to be having economic problems based on energy, on fuel. And the thing that really frosts me to the max on this is that, you know, there's more energy delivered by the sun in a few hours than this whole entire planet uses in an entire year. So, I mean, we've got a solar surplus here. All we have to figure is how to get a finger in it, how to use it. And the beginning of this is the photovoltaics and the solar hot water and the solar heating.
Well, with the existing infrastructure and the way we have it right now, Richard, people like you can talk until you're blue in the face, but the only thing in the end that's going to move people is going to be money. Now, that's what moves people. And as the price of oil goes up, if your statement about peak oil is correct, then That'll move people. You won't have to say anything to them. They'll start desperately looking for something that'll get the job done, get them to work and back, whatever, get out for vacation, whatever it takes. They're going to be looking for that, Richard. Money will do that. The question is, how soon?
Well, in a lot of cases, it's here already. A more efficient vehicle. How about a solar hot water heater? Okay? A solar hot water heater installed in your home, it's going to cost you $2,000 maybe.
Yes.
You will pay that back in a 2 to 5 year period. It'll make money for you versus burning natural gas or electricity for your hot water. Very simple thing. You don't have to modify your house. It just, pretty much goes in on the roof and that's it. There are many types of ways of using solar, and it's just a matter of doing it, when the time comes around.
And it's a matter of cost. I mean, we're going to convince, obviously, this morning, we will convince some people to begin making moves now. I'm sure we will, because it's sensible. But the greater mass out there that may not even be listening tonight, those people are not going to begin to move until they're forced to move, and money is going to force them to move. So how oil goes, the price of oil, is going to control, I think, what people do en masse. Don't you?
Yes, very much so. It just hit $44 a barrel. That's the highest price ever for oil.
Why is it that high?
It's that high because of supply and demand. There just isn't that much around. During the last oil crisis in the 70s, the Mideast sort of bailed us out. I mean, they had capacity that they could pump. And now, at this point, they don't. According to the OPEC nations, they're producing a capacity right now.
I have a question for you, Richard.
Yes.
I understand we have some strategic oil reserves, but after that, if something blew up in the Middle East and we were cut off from Mideast oil, if the U.S. was cut off from Mideast oil, what timeline do we have before America begins grounding to a halt?
Oh, a matter of weeks.
A matter of weeks.
Yes.
When I mean grounding to a halt, I mean the 18-wheelers that haul stuff from point A to point B get to the point where there's no more diesel for them, or diesel's at such a price that it's not worth it. Yeah, that's what I mean by grind to a halt.
Yes. A matter of weeks. We're getting a lot of our oil from South America, from Venezuela, from Colombia. But this is not enough to keep, every gas station pumping. We're at the cusp here. We're at the at a point of decision, if you will. We cannot long continue doing as we are doing now. The consequences economically are immense. I mean, currently, the U.S. government, we're not paying a set price at the gas pump. It's like we're not paying a set price at our electric meter in our home. Currently the U.S. government is subsidizing the oil industry to the tune of $1.8 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
Approximately half of the cost of your electric bill is concealed in your taxes. We've been lulled into thinking that energy is a very cheap commodity. If you go to Germany or to Great Britain, you're going to find that gas is twice as expensive, electricity is twice as expensive. Why? Because you're paying for the actual cost of the energy. You're not subsidizing it through your taxes.
Right.
So we've been lulled into thinking that this stuff is cheap and plentiful, when in fact it's not.
And what would be the motivation of lulling us in this manner? Why?
Because the powers that be are closely business-linked with the oil and energy industries. In other words, government and industry hand-in-hand picking our pockets.
Uh-huh. Well, even that group, though, Richard, would have to foresee peak oil and then a declining availability and a sharply rising price, and what that would do. Even the people you just talked about have got to see that, and it would affect their pocketbooks as well. So there's going to come a time when they have to make the moves, don't they? And
yes,
by they, I mean our government, our leadership.
When the gas pumps run dry, then our leadership will start thinking about doing something else.
But it's going to be a little late by then, isn't it?
It's going to be a lot late by then. And that's why I keep preaching the solar Bible. I mean, the sun, all energy on this planet comes from the sun, one form or another, with the possible exception of nuclear. We just need to start tuning in to this infinite, long-lasting, benign nuke 93 million miles from here.
All right, hold it right there, Richard. We'll be back, and we're going to take phone calls. If you have a question about energy, well, we're your people. So coming up in the next hour, we'll let all of you ask questions of Richard Perez from Home Power Magazine. I understand that I'm asking the impossible, and it is the impossible, but, it, you know, somehow or another, what we're talking about is so important, the conservation of energy, the correct use of energy, and the harvesting of the natural energy that we're not harvesting is so damned important that I wish it could be separated from politics. Now, you know, in the course of the interview, it's already very apparent Richard Perez is not a Bush guy at all, not even close. The problem, of course, with expressing publicly your political views is that, you know, about half the country goes, ah, he's a Bush basher, click. And, you know, the radio's off, or they've stopped listening the moment they detect their favorite guy getting, you know, or they think he's getting bashed. If there was some way, Richard, to separate the politics from just the cold, hard facts of energy, diminishing energy availability, and ultimately a crisis and what's coming. I mean, all of that is just a fact that's ahead of us, Richard. And but you can't sell them. You can't take it away from politics, can you?
No, you really can't. I mean, it is a fact. Oil is finite. It is a fact that we've already used most of it up, and that it's going to become very dear. It is a fact that burning coal in our power plants is the number one air polluter in America. You know, these are all facts. The politics is
intrinsically tied into it.
Yes, it's interwoven into it. It's the reason why we're not doing something else. It's a reason why the oil industry gets $1.8 billion a year in subsidies, but there's only $24 million allocated for renewable energy.
That's incredible.
Our government fosters energy technologies. It spurs research. Little things like, let's not mandate a change in the miles per gallon for automobiles. Let's just forget about that for a while. As a matter of fact, let's cut it back a little.
Let's take that huge thing and talk about it for a second. I remember that there were mileage figures that were given to the major car companies in America, and they said, by such and such, you will achieve such and such. Well, the automobile makers came back and said, we can't do it. We can't make it. We can't do it. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
So
we're doing it. I'm driving around in a car that's getting 60 miles to the gallon downtown.
So they lied to us?
Yes.
They lied to the lawmakers.
Yes.
All right. Richard.
There's a tremendous amount of inertia when you're in business. When you're in business, you want to keep doing what you're doing, particularly if it's successful, particularly if you're making money doing it.
That's right. Yes.
Business is inherently conservative. You don't want changes. But these are changes that we have to make. We're going to have no choice shortly. You know, probably within my lifetime and probably within yours, Art, and definitely within our children's lifetime.
Big difference there, Richard. Big difference. You know, I mean, really big difference. If I think it's during my lifetime, in fact, if I think it's in the next few years, I'm going to get off my butt and I'm going to start doing all kinds of things. If I think, well, I'm being really honest here, and I think I'm representing a lot of American people. If I think it's my children or my children's children, that's their damn problem.
Mm.
I won't be around.
Yeah.
That's an attitude, you know?
It definitely is.
All right, we need to take some calls. A lot of people want to talk to you, so let's see what they've got on their mind. First time caller line, you're on the air with Richard Perez.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
What is your name and where are you?
This is Ian. I'm from Silver Spring, Maryland.
Okay, Ian. Welcome. What's your question?
Okay. Now, realistically speaking for myself and probably a few other people at this time and in the foreseeable future, I live in an apartment, so it's. I've been thinking about this as I've been listening.
Good.
So, one thing that occurs to me is that I don't know what option is there. That's the question. I was thinking some kind of big wind-up kind of thing that is something like that available. Is there a solar option for someone like myself?
All right, that's a look, super question, actually. All right, Richard, he represents millions of Americans. He lives in an apartment. So what can he do? What should he do?
Well, the first thing is all the energy-efficient appliances, for example, lighting. For example, save energy by not using it. And I'm not talking doing without. I'm just talking doing whatever you're doing efficiently. For example, television sets, VCRs, microwave ovens sit around and suck up power 24/7. Put them on a plug strip, shut them off when you're not using them. Things such as that. You can go one step further. We ran an article in Home Power about a folks who lived in an apartment. They put two modules off the balcony out into the sun, put in a small utility intertied inverter, plugged it in the wall. There you go. They're not making a lot of power, just a few hundred watts, but they're making something.
I'm going to ask you a question, Richard, and I try and answer here honestly. I remember some years ago, California got into a severe water crisis, or a part of California, and they urged the people, please save water, save water, and they actually outlined the steps for people to save water. And the people, they did so well, Richard. They saved so much water that guess how they got rewarded? The price of water went up.
Well,
couldn't that happen with electricity? I mean, if people start saving,
yep,
then the companies are making less money, and could the end result of their efforts be to have their bills raised for that reason?
The price of electricity is going up one way or another, all right? Self-interest here, I haven't paid an electric bill in 34 years.
That's okay. Pretty good, yeah.
All right, so there you go. As more and more people get solar electric systems and as they become grid intertied, those without solar electric systems are going to see a raise in the price of power. It's just inevitable because they're going to be making less of it and they're going to be brokering it. The good news is that a lot of what the utilities are going to be brokering is your neighbor's solar. This is a transition phase. I mean, you know, we're to look at this as if we're going to convert everything next year or even in the next decade is ridiculous. This is going to be a gradual change that is going to happen over many decades, and we basically don't have any choice. We're going to have to do this one way or another.
All right. Here's Garrett, and you can tell he's a member of the other crowd, Richard, from Wallop, Washington. He says, these people, that would be you, Richard, these people don't seem to want to acknowledge the danger of 6 to 10 year lifespans of the batteries and the environmental impact of the disposal of those batteries. I mean, what's up with that? That's more harmful and dangerous to the environment than what we got now.
That's horse pucky. There is no industry in America. To begin with, the lifetime isn't 6 to 7 years. It's more on the order of 15 to 20. And there is no industry in America that has a better recycling history than the lead-acid battery industry. Chances are the battery in your car has been in 3 or 4 other cars before you got it, the lead in that battery. The lead-acid battery industry has a much better recycling history than aluminum, glass, or any other consumer-type product. And if you go into a utility intertie situation where you're selling your solar back to the grid, you don't even have to have batteries. These are batteryless systems.
Pretty good answer for Garrett. All right. Wild card line, you're on the air with Richard Perez. Hello? Yes,
hello.
Is
this me?
Yeah, well, only you know that for certain, but it sounds like you, yes.
All righty. My name is Linda. I live in California, but I'm in Boulder City, Nevada right now, and I listened to you folks for the last hour, and it was all static, but it was so important and so interesting, I was glued to the radio. And I used to listen to you, Art, all the time a couple years ago, but I wasn't able to get you anymore in Long Beach, so I need to know your radio station. I need to know the phone number so I can get that recording.
There's like 500 and something radio stations, ma'am. You'll have to pick one out. Do you have a question for my guest?
I do. I have a camper trailer that I'd like to use some of your systems on when I'm camping, and I'd also like to find out who I can call. I have a house in Boulder City, and my son's electric bill is like sometimes $225 a month.
Yeah, see, that gets your attention.
It's got my attention because I can't afford both houses and help him out with the
electric bills
because I'm a widow. And I've got so many questions I don't even know where to begin.
Get a copy of the program is what I would recommend to you first. Now, with respect to the camping question, that's a pretty good one, Richard. What can people with little campers and that kind of thing do?
Oh, that's a simple job. They've got a battery already. Sometimes they have a generator in them. Modern RVs and campers are coming with solar equipped right on the roof from the factory these days. It's easy to retrofit 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 modules onto the roof, put them into the battery, put an inverter in there, kiss your generator goodbye.
It's the truth, folks. I did it. When I bought my RV years ago, first thing I did is put 500 watts of solar on the roof. And, oh, boy, that goes a long way, doesn't it, Richard?
It goes a long way. One of the RV stories that we wrote up in Home Power, this fellow went crazy. He's got over 17 modules on the roof of his RV. When he pulls into the house, what he does is he runs an extension cord from the RV,
plugs it
into the house, and runs his house off his RV. Now, in terms of your electric bill, that's incredibly high, Linda. So what you need to do is investigate your consumption. Something there is using a whole lot more power than it should be.
There's a question within a question, Richard. Fine. How do you investigate your consumption? Can you take, like, one of these portable little clamp-on ammeters and go around to your various appliances in the house, have an electrician do it, and find out what each one is using?
Oh, yeah. And you don't need an electrician. The meters are $29, $39, $49. They're advertised in Home Power. You just plug it into the wall socket, plug the appliance in, leave it run a few days. It'll tell you how many kilowatt hours it's using.
Oh.
It'll tell you instantaneous consumption, and it's just the ticket for things like refrigerators, water heaters, and things that operate intermittently. Investigate that, and your local renewable energy dealer, and there are thousands of them around the nation at this point. You can find out about them on Home Power's website. There's a searchable database on there.
All right, let's tell them how to get the magazine, Richard.
Okay. You can get, first place to get it is on the web. If you've got access to the web, you can go to our website, and you can download for free our entire current issue, cover to cover.
Really?
Yes, the entire magazine.
Wow.
For free, and that's www.homepower.com. com.
How are you going to ever make a living when you give it away?
Believe me, we're surviving. We're not in this to get rich. Everybody, there's only 14 of us working on the company, and everybody is paid enough to get by, and we're happy with that. So we're giving it away on the web, and we've been doing this for the last 6 years. So this is not a new thing. Now, if you want it via paper, if you want a subscription or something, you can call our number on Monday, and that's 800-707-6585, 800-707-6585, and we can fix you up with a subscription via paper.
All right, that's 1-800-707-6585?
That's right.
All right, and a subscription, how much?
$22.50 a year, and that'll buy you 6 issues. We come out bi-monthly. And we're now in our 16th year of publication.
All right. Why, Richard, is the RV world so far ahead of the housing world in terms of alternative power and so forth?
Well,
I mean,
because
they're miles ahead of them.
Yeah, because they're not tied down to an electric line all the time. You're often in a place where it is inconvenient or impossible to plug in. So what are you? Well, I mean, you're in the same situation that I am at home. You're off grid, and if you're off grid, you have two choices. You can run a generator, which is noisy, smelly, and very expensive, or you can do something else. And something else that these people are doing is solar, and it's just revolutionized the RV industry. It's an option on most RVs these days.
Absolutely. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Richard Perez. Hello.
Good morning. Buonasera.
Good morning. Where are you?
This is Nancy from Shrewsbury calling.
Okay.
I had a couple questions. First of all, could there be conversion kits for cars, and would that be possible? Because maybe we should have some cars that still stay on using gasoline.
All right.
Because, and then another thing is my company imports 90% of their products from China. I'm concerned about that.
Yeah, a lot of people are. Okay, Richard. Conversion first. That's a very good question. The cars that are on the road right now, is there any realistic conversion for them?
In terms of a hybrid electric vehicle like the Prius or the Hondas, no. That's got to be built in right from the ground up. In terms of converting these cars to pure electrics, yes. The Volkswagen Rabbit, there are kits out there to do this, to, you know, jerk the engine and replace it with electrics and batteries.
Huh.
The Chevy S10 pickup, there are kits available for it. But these are pure electrics now, and pure electrics at this point in time have problems. I mean, they have a limited range,
right?
And you know, they take a while to recharge. You're not going to pull it into a recharge station and fill it up in 15 minutes.
And they don't get the little jackrabbit starts that Americans like.
No,
so much.
They're generally slower. I mean, they'll freeway cruise, but they're generally slower. So conversion kits are available. Now, if you have a diesel rig, then you can go biodiesel almost instantly.
Right.
Most diesel rigs will run on biodiesel with minimal to no conversion at all.
All right. She asked about China, and I agree with her. If you've been to China, seen China, know what's going on in China, it will scare the hell out of you. What do you think about China, Richard?
You know, I don't know what to think. So I'm going to just pass on that. I don't have the expertise to deal with that. I know that they are going renewable energy more quickly than I've ever seen any pre-industrial type nation do it. They've got lots and lots of rural villages running on diesel generators. They're trying to get rid of those. They are producing a tremendous volume of consumer gear under what I would consider to be basically slave labor type conditions. But
All right, hold it right there. We've got a break for the bottom of the hour. We'll get you on the line with Richard Perez from Home Power Magazine if you stay right where you are. I think this might punctuate what I just said. Mark, the webmaster, not of this website, he writes and says, hey, looks like your guests website has crashed and burned. Well, we do that to a lot of websites on this program, but that is an indicator of the kind of interest that there is right now in all of this, Richard, and I'm getting a landslide of interest. You know, people fast-blasting in giant multitudes, people emailing me and all the rest of it. In other words, the interest level is extremely high right now, both positive and negative, I have to say, but very high, and so I don't remember that day. We've done shows like this before, and people go, you know, they don't respond because what they pay at the pump is, well, you know, annoying but okay. What they pay for their electric bill, annoying but, you know, okay. And they were comfortably ready not to take any action. But, you know, it seems like we've reached a kind of a, I don't know, we're at a certain point here. We're about to go over that point. Huh.
Oh, yeah. We've definitely reached the point. We're beyond it now. The costs for energy are going to go up. It's going to become more and more available. And what scares me more than that is the fragility of the lines of supply, oil, of electricity. I mean, all it takes is a tree limb or a power plant to go out and bang. We've got, you know...
Well, maybe you would like to address that, Richard, because, you know, the old story about the grid was that the grid is interconnected everywhere. So, like the internet, why, you can't take it out. Because if you take out one little part of the grid, the rest of it doesn't go down. It's protected. But, well, you know, it just doesn't seem in reality like it happens that way. When we have the entire northeast part of the country, or the American southwest, or the western part of the country, it goes out, and then eventually they trace it to... They always say, you know, something fell on a line over there in the deepest part of Michigan somewhere or some damn thing, and that caused it all. How can that happen when the grid is supposed to prevent all that?
Well, it could prevent all that if it was had the capacity to do it. But the point is that we have stretched it to the absolute limit. You know, there's a... 2 years ago, we had... blackouts and brownouts in California because folks were using more than they could get their hands on. And part of this was financial, part of it was technical. But the point is that the grid is stretched to the max. All it takes is a small problem, and it instantly magnifies. And it's not going to get any better. We haven't been putting in new generating capacity. We haven't been putting in new lines.
So then to me, again, the concept of the grid was one part goes down, the rest of it picks it up. What you're saying is that every one of these facilities is stretched right to the very end of its capacity. So when one little one goes down, the next one goes over capacity, boom, it goes down, the next one, boom, goes down, and it gets worse as you go.
That's right. That's right. And the only way to prevent this is to, A, use less, and, B, produce more. And producing more, in my book, means, hey, get your own first, all right? Put solar up on your house. If you do this, then when the grid goes out, if you have some batteries in there, you won't even know it happened.
Yeah, well, then, to me, this means, Richard, that the entire concept of the saving concept of the grid is really its Achilles heel as well.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Okay, listen, a lot of people want to talk. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Richard Perez. Hello.
Hi. My name is Red, and I'm from northern Arizona.
Welcome.
And thank you. And I live in a mobile home, and I wondered if there's any manufacturers out there that are making solar-friendly mobiles.
That's an awfully good question.
In general, no, because of the nature of the home and the fact that it has to be moved. But I'll tell you what... solar installers have been doing for mobile homes. We'll put you up a power shed right outside, a little 10 by 12 shed up right outside, PVs on the roof, batteries if you want them, inverter inside, and your house can be as solar as anyone else's house. And if you want, you know, we can also put solar hot water up on there too, so your water is heated by solar.
All right, I have a question about pre-manufactured homes, Richard. Mobile homes, whatever you want to call them. You know, they have very nice double, even triple wide ones now. There's a story out there that's widely believed, and I want to know if it's true or not, and that's that pre-manufactured homes are because of the nature of the way they're made, you know, they're made in mass, right? And they're manufactured, so they actually have better tolerances in the home, and they actually have a foot-for-foot better insulation as well. Is that a true statement, or is that, what would you use, horse pucky?
No, that is a true statement for some of them, and anybody buying a manufactured home should look at the R values.
Right.
And thoroughly, because you can get them all over the place.
Well, the stories you hear are, well, since they're manufactured, you know, the tolerances are better. You don't have leaks and drafts in the house and that kind of thing. And that.
Well, that's pretty much horsepucky because, you know, most modern construction is wrapped in Tyvek and vapor barriers. And homes are getting so tight these days, regardless of whether they're pre-manufactured or assembled
not.
By carpenters, that you're going to have air quality problems inside the house. So, you know, that's a matter of air leakage. When you're dealing with thermal characteristics, you're dealing strictly with insulation.
Gotcha. All right. International Line, you're on the air with Richard Perez. Hello, where are you?
I'm calling from Tassus, British Columbia.
Okay, what's
up? Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Geez, first off, your plane coy is oil loafer on the June after dark. But at any rate, the cost of oil. I work on a research vessel, and to fuel that thing up, what, $100,000 Canadian at a go. Military vessels, the number of fleets out there running on diesel fuel, that, you know, on a severely tapped oil system, that it, you know,
yes,
the crunch has to come, I suppose.
Yes.
I run a diesel. Are we allowed to mention brand names?
No.
Okay. Well, I have a.
I mean, we could, but I'm not letting you. I mean, what is your overall question, sir?
I'm running a 1986 pickup truck on a four-cylinder diesel engine that I run on fryer fat, basically.
Okay.
And now I'm looking to try and manufacture my own. I've heard in India and in China.
Try and manufacture your own what?
Biodiesel, basically.
All right. Richard, how about that?
Easy to do.
Really?
Easy to do. You just take a bunch of oil, and this can be used oil, like French fry oil or donut oil or whatever.
Yeah.
And you heat it up, and you put a little sodium hydroxide, that's lye, in there. And then you warm it up. It breaks up the long fatty chains into shorter chains. This is a something you can do in your garage. We've
really?
Got instructions on how to do this in home power.
Oh, great.
It's easy to do.
So you use lye, and you break it down, and then it's ready to use?
That's ready to use. And the only change you're going to notice in your diesel is your exhaust is going to smell like French fries.
How happy are people who are using that kind of lash-up?
Oh, extremely happy, so much so that commercially made biodiesel is available in 3 filling stations in the local valley around
us
here.
No kidding. Really?
Yes. And it costs a bit more than regular diesel. Why? I have no idea, mainly because it's new.
But you're telling me now, I've got an RV. It's a diesel RV. And so I could go fill up somewhere on this stuff and smell like a big rolling French fry?
Yeah.
You're telling me?
Yeah.
And it wouldn't harm my diesel engine?
No.
Well, that kind of sounds like fun.
It's easily doable.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Richard Perez. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Hey, I'm calling from Palmdale, California.
Yes, sir.
And it's a pretty windy place up here, so I made the commitment. I went ahead and I put in a wind electric system, and I got the rebate here from California, the renewables buy-down rebate.
Right.
But about 9 months after I installed the unit, I had a major meltdown, and I had to ship it back to the factory, and they had the thing for about 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
They promised it to me after about 5 weeks.
Right.
So, consequently, it's been 9 months, and I finally was able to put the thing back up last week, and it's really nice to see my meter spin backwards again. But I want to ask Richard, and I am a subscriber to Home Power Magazine, by the way, Richard, and I really like your magazine.
Oh, thank you.
My question, though, for you is what is your opinion of the small wind industry?
All right. Well, that's such a very good question. I have the same question, Richard. The small wind industry, it is a small industry, and I, too, have had a couple of wind generators up, albeit beta testing for the companies. But, you know, I've had a little trouble, and I had to pull it down, put up new ones. Where are we today?
Well, I wish I could say these things were trouble-free. They are not. I've had 3 wind generators in the last 10 years. They break.
Yeah.
It is a very difficult job to put something like that up on a tower and just say, we're not going to deal with it. There are maintenance issues.
Right.
Some are better than others. You get what you pay for. But, you know, wind is, in my opinion, for the folks who are into maintenance, who are into tinkering, who are into, let's climb up the tower and check it out.
No,
and
see, that wouldn't be me.
Then you're a solar kind of guy, and I'm a solar kind of guy. I've got a wind generator up. It's down right now, but I'm putting another one up.
Well, wind should be, it's like the cheapest per kilowatt I had heard, that wind was actually cheaper than solar.
It is cheaper than solar. As a matter of fact, the major new capacity that utilities are installing is wind, but we're not talking home scale here. We're talking megawatt.
Okay,
but
the maintenance, I mean, you said it yourself. The caller said it. I, too, admit it. I'm waiting on the newest, latest, greatest model. The question is, are we approaching a point where a person can go buy a wind generator, put it up, and forget it like they can
solar panel?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. No.
We're not going to do that. I mean, solar panels, you stick them out in the sun, they're warranted for 25 years these days.
Yeah.
And they're going to be producing energy probably for 50 to 100 years. There's nothing that is as supremely reliable as a solar panel. I'm sorry, that's just the way it is.
Okay, well, I'll let you know the latest. I'm going to do that pretty soon. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Richard Perez. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling about, a quick program note. Tomorrow when you do the UFO thing, a bumper song that you don't play very much is wonderful, called If I Ever Am Abducted, Don't Let It Be the Gray.
Oh, it's been a long time.
If you have that, it's so wonderful.
All right, well, we'll see.
Okay, the other thing is there is a sky car that you interviewed the professor that was making that some years back.
That would be the Mahler sky car, yes.
Yes, and I think that would be fabulous as a new energy source. And the third thing is about...
Wait. It wouldn't be a source, dear.
The
Mahler energy car would have to use fuel.
Well, I thought it would, was a... He had different ways of having it go than I... When you interview him next time, I'm looking forward to it to see what he's put it together. And also Bob Lazar, maybe between the two of them.
Okay.
You know, with Bob Lazar's stuff and his.
All right. Well, let's talk for a second about Bob Lazar and hydrogen. Now, Richard, I believe that President Bush has begun motion to move us toward a hydrogen energy source economy. What do you say about that?
Probably not in his lifetime, but this whole business with fuel cells, they're called fuel cells for a reason. They take fuel. The fuel is hydrogen. Where we are getting this hydrogen right now for these fuel cells is natural gas.
It takes power to make power?
Yes. Fuel cells are not energy producers, they are merely energy converters.
See, a lot of people have it fixed in their mind, fuel cell. Sounds like it's something from Star Trek almost.
No.
And they think that it generates energy. And it's just a container for hydrogen, and you got to get the hydrogen in there, right?
From somewhere, yes. Now, if we were to make this hydrogen from the electrolysis of water, from splitting water up into hydrogen and oxygen,
yes.
And if we were to use the electricity that did that from solar, wind, then we have a sustainable setup, and fuel cells are part of it. But if we're using natural gas...
Well, is that realistic to create hydrogen from water using, let's say, solar cells as the electrical source? Is that...
Absolutely.
It is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been done before. It's been done at a number of places, in universities, experimentally, by home power readers in their backyards. It's doable.
And you run stories, do you not, about people who do exactly that, the story of how they do it, how the mechanism is
yes.
put together, and how they end up with the hydrogen, and how they use it. It includes all of that?
And how they use the hydrogen, yes.
That's
they use
pretty
it,
cool.
They use it not only through fuel cells, but they burn it in room heaters. They burn it in stoves. And hydrogen is a wonderful thing to burn because the only byproduct is water, no carbon involved.
Right.
But if you're putting natural gas into this, then you're adding another load to an already overstressed natural gas system. I mean, we're running short of this stuff. We don't need to be planning an economy based around it.
Right, okay. All right, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with Richard Perez. Hello.
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 I'm proud of you two fellows and what you've done so much better than myself. Two quick statements and a question. One... The question is do these LEDs that run off 120-volt AC make noise and interfere with my radio reception of Art Bell?
The answer to that is no. I run them here, sir. They don't bother anything. Next question.
The next question is this, these are statements where you use that foam on the outside the house where you get cold up in Canada. Don't make it more than about 1 5/8 inch thick, otherwise it becomes a vapor barrier and you'll get ice out there on the wall.
Is that something you agree with, Richard?
Yes.
Okay.
And don't run your refrigerator where it's beneath 50 or 60 degrees. You'll violate the warranty and destroy the compressor at about $600.
Is that right, Richard?
I run mine down to about 35 degrees. I've been running our RE refrigerator that way for, almost 11 years now, no problems.
Okay, well, you know, I guess everybody wants to, you know, separate the bull from the real McCoy, and Home Power Magazine does that?
Yes. I mean, our entire crew lives with the products that we write up, and, you know, we have a half the crew off-grid. The rest of them are utility intertied. You know, when we write something up, it's no bull. We're talking about personal experience here.
That's certainly worthwhile. So you all live what you write. You live it.
Yes. That's how we got started doing this, we started doing it for ourselves, and we said, hey, you know, this is great, and we want to tell folks about it. And that's how we got started doing this 16 years ago.
And are you ever tempted to write anything that you ought not because of a potential sponsor for an advertisement for your magazine?
We have lost full-page advertisements because I refuse to write up products. We will not accept advertising from products that we know are not as advertised. We just don't do that.
Well, that's called integrity, and I think you've got a lot of it. Richard, thank you for being here tonight. The program is over. We're out of time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Art. I enjoyed it immensely.
You're very welcome, my friend. Good night. That's Richard Perez from Home Power Magazine. Tomorrow night, Dr. Stephen Greer, along with ABC. It's going to be quite a night. Quite a night indeed. Richard Greer has been threatened. Tomorrow night, you'll get to hear it from the high desert. Good night.